to the Mary Mack Show, where we will be talking about your feelings, experiences, and pain following the death of a loved one. In this week's episode, we're going to finalize our conversation with Marika Cole. She is an advocate out in Sacramento, California for drug-induced homicide, and she is willing to explain to us all that she's been doing to help bring more justice to those who have been killing our kids to fentanyl and carfentanil poisonings. So I hope you will listen in and share it with others who need to know this information. And please subscribe, rate, like, and comment so that others will learn more about this, that the algorithms will pick us up and increase our reach. So we thank you so much. Have a great week.
And, you know, there's already laws on the books about fentanyl and how many years you could get if you possess it. What kind of scheduled drug is. And the only difference that I can say is that it's not clear if they're talking about medical fentanyl. It's not clear. But clearly, it doesn't say, you know, manufactured by in a lab or anything like that. It just says fentanyl is illegal to possess, you know, and to sell, and the time that people could get. And some people are getting off. They have pills in their possessions. They have pill presses. There was a recent case in Los Angeles about a guy who was pulled over. He had pills. He had drugs. He had money. He had a scale. He had baggies. Obviously, he was a drug dealer. And he got arrested and was let go that day. The next day,
the kind of thing with these judges.
Yes, he got it was that day. And what was crazy about it, and it was a recent case where the guy got 15 and a half years for killing a 17-year-old with fentanyl. 17 days later, she was poisoned with fentanyl. Had they kept him in, had they taken all these pills that he had, the scale, the baggies, all the money that he had,
they didn't take that and confiscate it?
Well, I'm sure they did, but they let him go. That is enough to hold somebody and say, you know, you're a danger to society. Fentanyl was already on the books as being dangerous, and you gave it to you're in your mid-20s and you gave it to a minor child, and it resulted in her death. And can you imagine being the parent and realizing, and you know, through the investigation that we had pulled him over and he walked. There was no true punishment at the time. I'm sure he had to go to future court date, but he continued doing it. It was a tiny slap on the wrist. He says, that's a lot of money I'm missing out on. I'm sure they took his money. So he continued to sell and resulted in deaths of multiple people. 17 days after that arrest. It's crazy to know. And this person in my case is doing what he's doing, still doing drugs, still hurting people. People are overdosing at this person's house. Every day that they don't pick them up is every day that someone else can overdose. And we know them very closely. My husband knew his grandfather. His grandfather moved out because the grandson's drug dealing. He lives with his grandfather. His grandfather rode motorcycles. He got to know my husband, you know, when we were in our 30s. And we've known them for a long time. And when this grandfather stopped riding his motorcycle, he sold my husband his motorcycle really cheap. He really wanted him to have it. And my husband is the type of person, I don't want to take anything from you. I want to pay you for it. So give me a fair price. And they worked it out. And that's, we knew their family. And I think that's why the grandson felt really compelled to say something. But I was just surprised that it implicated not just him, but two other people in this whole scheme of things involving his Cash App card. It's just devastating. And a lot of people, they don't know, they learn who the drug dealer is. In my case, I knew after getting into my son's phone what had happened and who it was. And it's very difficult when you know, I don't know. I think they're both devastating, but you know the person, you were like, could you do that? When my first son passed away, we made t-shirts with his picture, Mario's picture, and it said RIP Super, because he went by Super. They called him Super because Super Mario. And on his Facebook page, he's got his shirt on. And I could go over there and knock on the door and he'll answer. And I just stopped going over there because I had already retrieved everything that I needed. But the last words I remember saying to him is, don't wear that shirt. If I see you at the store and you've got that shirt on, I'm going to rip it off your body. And I don't think that he wears the shirt. If he does, he's inside the house, you know. But I was very serious. Like, how could you do this to my family?
Right.
You were close to my boys when you were growing up, and they stopped hanging out with him because he started selling drugs, and they put a stop to it. And I found out that 5 months before Merrick passed away, my middle son went to him and said, I don't want my brother coming over here. And he bops him real good and says, if you let him over here, then you're going to have nothing but problems with me and my brothers, especially with me. And so in this confession, it mentions, and I had to ask about it, his brother told me not to let him in, and I didn't. And my question to him was, why did you that day?
Yeah, because you had gotten everything. You had gotten everything you wanted.
Well, why did he let him in that day that he passed? Because remember, I didn't recover all his stuff till later.
Oh,
they had, yeah, I recovered it later. I'm just talking about the message where he confessed. He said his brother told me not to let him in, so I didn't. But he did. That day that he passed, he let him in. And that's when they decided that he's not going to smoke it. He's not going to, we got to, you know, it was in a drink form. Fentanyl is tasteless and it's odorless. And this is another thing that I'm telling moms and families, that if you go to a picnic and you, your child, or you, even you, prepare a plate and you walk away from it and you come back, make another plate.
Yes.
Because people, if they have a problem with you, they don't know. Some people don't know how dangerous it is. They just want to see you, you know, fall on the floor or act goofy. It could kill. Kids will drop things in a drink. Watch what happens, because kids are cruel, as we learned through Merrick's experience.
Sure.
And if
and
you
just all the girls who are at bars, you know, and they drop
yes, if you sit
roofies
your
in their drink and rape them,
and it should be held in the same fashion, this accountability, as soon as you taint somebody's whatever it is, drunk, you know, if they're an alcoholic and they get a drink, well, maybe they shouldn't be drinking, but that's their drug of choice. As soon as someone taints that with a poison that causes them to be incoherent or die, it's a crime. It's a crime. It's
Yes.
definitely a crime for GHB, anything that you drink, you know, sprinkle in food. It's illegal, and street level fentanyl should be treated the same way. The same way. If someone asks for cocaine, let's say they have an addiction, this is where we need to end the stigma. And this is my main message, is that somebody can have an addiction for years to cocaine and
Yes.
meth, or they can be a meth addict and be a manageable meth addict and go to work.
Yeah.
If they lose their job because of a mishap at work and they were drug tested, then that's part of the laws and rules that we have to follow. But as soon as someone taints that drug of choice with fentanyl, it'll surely kill them. And if it didn't that this time, it will another time. And the drug dealer's thought process is to make it a little bit more addictive so they'll keep coming back. And so it creates this addiction that it's unexplainable. I've talked to people and they said, I can't even explain the addiction that when you try to do without it, you feel like you're going to die. And so they have to keep doing it. So if it's somebody's drug of choice and it gets tainted, it should be illegal. You know, when we had the Tylenol scare, somebody was tainting Tylenol. If you remember the big
yes.
process,
Yes.
the big investigation, and they had cameras and was looking to find out who it was. And they did all that over Tylenol. When we had the anthrax scare, they had all point bulletins. They had camera. They had did this. Everybody was on board. The post office, the postmaster. They had attorney generals. They had governors. They had everybody on board with finding out who was distributing anthrax. And yet, here we have fentanyl killing hundreds of thousands of people, including small children, in gummies and rainbow fentanyl. And we don't hear about what's being done about it. Some of it's being mailed. You don't hear about postmasters jumping on board saying, we need to scan and make sure that there's no drugs in our mail
yeah.
system. And, you know, it's just devastating. The loss of a child is devastating, and it takes not just one victim. It victimizes the whole family. And in some cases, parents are committing suicide because of the loss of their child. They can't function. They can't no longer work. So they're losing their home, their car, because of the loss of a child. There's no, when you find out that the law, if they do investigate that the child has been victimized and they are a victim of homicide, there's what's called a victim's compensation plan that most states have. California does have one for
yes.
people that are victims of homicide. And truly, from this is just my perspective, is that if they don't call it, if they continue to call it an overdose, they don't have to pay out that victim fund for mental health, for your medication, for your well-being.
The funeral.
The funeral, exactly. And to put profit, let's say again, and I'll say it again, to put profit and money over human lives and not to stop it because of a victim compensation plan is also just as devastating.
Yes. Yes.
And that's part of the problem. Not only do we have a peddler problem that's peddling fentanyl, but we have on the side of the victim's compensation where they, attorney generals, they create these victim compensation plans. And, you know, the district attorney's office say, yeah, they were a victim of crime. They have this big thing about victims of crimes. But it would be so politically devastating to them to show on victims, you know, they have memorial days for victims of homicide.
Victims' Rights Day. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Victims' Rights Day.
Can you imagine?
Can you imagine being the DA and having the park full of parents that lost their kids? Well, that would be politically devastating. And I think that plays a part on their decision. And I hope not. I hope not. We have a pretty good DA that is trying to address the homelessness, talking to the city about, what are you doing? You're allowing it. And he sued the city. He sued, Thienho sued the city. He's doing what he can, but a little bit more needs to be done when it comes to fentanyl and how it's being handled. Definitely right off the bat, they need to secure the scene, gather cell phone evidence, gather whatever's in the person's pocket. Some parents are being told, go ahead and empty their pocket and take it home. And, you know, because it's an overdose, just take, and they do, they take the wallet, they take the phone. Some of the parents have the phone. They don't know what to do. They're like, this was an overdose. They called it. And I said, but usually it takes an attorney to determine what the court will listen to and what they won't listen to. And that's where a district attorney needs to be given the case to determine that. Not an officer, they're not an attorney, not the person on the scene, not even the, let's say, a lead homicide detective. They're not skilled in the arena of being an attorney to know what would stick in a courtroom and what would not.
Yes.
Their job is to hand over all the evidence to determine if a case can be made out of it. And that's where the devastation, the second devastation occurs, when there's no evidence gathering. There's no cell phone. Let's check to see if we can get into the cell phone. Usually it's the last few things that were said, they can piece it together. And I believe that at least 90% of these cases could be solved just by the cell phone contact. The, you know, Snapchat has its own problems, and we know there are victims of Snapchat where the messages disappear. As soon as you open it, you read it, and they disappear. Mm-hmm. And
isn't it interesting that the drug dealers know that that's their social media of choice, so they won't be found out?
And, you know, the crazy thing about drug dealers is, why on earth, you know, they take Cash App that can be tracked. They want that money so bad that they're not thinking, you know, they're not thinking. And every opportunity not to hold the cell phone and find out what's in the cell phone. Every time they do that, it's a devastation for the family. It's no justice. The cell phone may have pulled the key to what happened to their child, and or what's in their pockets, what's in, you know, any notes. Were there any witnesses? They don't go the full investigation. They look at it. They'll report it. Coroner comes. They make a determination it was fentanyl, And then they say it is a, they'll either say it's a fentanyl overdose or intoxication by fentanyl or something that alludes to the fact that it was the victim's fault, the person who died. And
well, that's the
it's not
easiest
right.
Thing to do, isn't it?
No report writing. You just report what you found, who you turned it over to. That's the easiest, and it's not the right answer. And that's why it's growing, and it won't stop growing unless people are held accountable, investigations occur. We have to be there for families to inform them, because so many times they will try to get a lawyer to sue the police, or they'll try to get a lawyer to take their case. And without understanding the process, a lawyer will say no because there was no case established. So it's
But
really
even
important
if they
for a
do,
person.
even if you get a lawyer, it's only for a civil case. It would never be for the legal system, because a regular trial attorney isn't, they don't, they're not representing you. Only the district attorney will represent you, technically, as state of California against.
Yeah, it's the attorney general's office that takes those cases, but some of them are pretty strong cases, because here I was ignored all this time, going through much more grief than I should have been, because I would cry like, how come nobody's listening to me? How come nobody hears me? How come they don't get it?
Right.
And then I'm talking to Matt, he says, this is how the political system works. And this is what we've been doing. The light turned on in my head. And I felt like I'm not the only one. Number one, I didn't feel alone anymore. And number two is, I've got to talk about this, because this is devastating for people that are currently have lost their kids. And I need to educate people in
the
case I
future.
run across somebody. And I go ahead.
No, I agree with you. It's and the sad part is the people who will come after us may never know any of this stuff until it's too late. That is really what upsets me the most, is how do nobody thinks that their child will die of fentanyl, okay, poisoning, or carfentanil.
Not my child syndrome. I call it the not my child syndrome.
And it's the same way in suicide and homicide and all the stigma, type of deaths. It's the same exact way. So you're not in tune to what could happen if, God forbid, this was in my family. It's not something on your radar. And then after something happens, you're like, oh, I wish I had known that. Or why didn't I know that? Or why wasn't this out there in the public for me to have learned, or whatever? And because of that, so now we have people who are victimized secondly, first, because of the child they lost, and second, as you mentioned, the information they didn't know.
And you know what? It's out there, and it's groups of parents that are putting the literature out there and coming to the county, and then the county says, oh, okay, they had the One Pill Can Kill campaign, which is amazing. It is amazing. But there are some moms like me that it wasn't one pill. It's other ways of getting it into our children's system. And that education needs to be talked about, as well as one pill can kill. Because, people have anxiety. They're like, do you have anything for anxiety? Oh, I hurt my leg at recess. Does anyone have it? Well, I've got this and it should help you. And then they get poisoned. And the One Pill Can Kill campaign is so important because social media, they'll sell it in pills. They'll, you know, it does have its root base, and it is so critical for people to know. But it's also just as critical for people to know about the 10-year-olds who went to school that were in the fourth grade and they got a hold of gummies and it made them very sick, found out that they had fentanyl in their system. They lived. They were given the naloxone to reverse the opioids. And the parents are like, why weren't we told about this? Because your child is 10. They don't think about drugs. They don't think about the influence of, here, try this. It's a gummy. It's a Skittle. It's a brownie. Remember when they were taking brownies with marijuana? I tell people to start talking to your children at 8 and 9, just not to take things from other people. You don't have to, you'll yeah. know when their knowledge base is more mature to talk about meth and heroin and stuff like that. We talk, your child is young. You talk about, if mommy and daddy don't give it to you, don't take anything from anybody. Whatever's in your lunch is what you eat, and don't leave your lunch on the table. You eat it right in front of you, and then you, you know, just that little bit of education is going to nurture them to not take things from people if you start them young. Now, peer pressure is a little bit different because as they mature into 11 and 12 year olds, they want friends, they want to fit in, they want to be popular, they don't want to be the outcast. And it's easier to talk to them when they're younger about, it's okay not to fit in. It's okay to be your own independent person.
Yeah.
You're the most important person in the room. Doesn't matter what everyone else is doing. And just keep encouraging them so that when they feel like they're bullied, they're like, I don't have to do what you guys do.
Yeah.
And they can say that with confidence because they have that knowledge and that nurturing at a younger age, that they automatically know that it's okay to be different. Hey, you know what? You guys are the weird ones. You guys are the ones doing stuff. And, I don't know 1,000% if my son had a real true addiction. He didn't show it by how often he stayed home. But I could always tell when someone gave him marijuana because he would be shutting the blinds. I'm like, hey, what are you doing? And he says, I'm shutting the blinds. And I said, well, can you tell me why you're doing that? Well, people might be looking in. I said, okay. And I said, are you sure you didn't smoke some weed? He goes, Mom. He goes, okay, maybe just a little. Because he had autism. He would just tell me. And I'm like, okay, so we'll see how many times that you'll understand what it does to you. You know, because he will shut the blinds like that in the middle of the day, by the way. And so I just let it be. And then he stopped. He said, Mom, guess what? You were right. I stopped smoking because I was tired of thinking that people were going to hurt me. And I was just being, you know, it stopped. That paranoia stopped. And it was, he said, this was the best thing that I did, Mom. But he could be influenced. Mm-hmm. He could be influenced. The girlfriend, when she did befriend me, she said, you know, he is different because he's the only person that I know that would try a drug and not do it again. Because he's wired different. I think that he's wired different. Addiction is very strong. But if he feels a certain way, he feels like someone is going to hurt him, that is stronger. That's stronger than an addiction. I really do believe that, because sometimes he would be a little bit off the hook and I'm like, what's going on? Well, somebody got him to try something. And And sometimes it took a few days and he just wouldn't go anywhere, but he was frantic. And I was like, I don't know if I could deal with this is, kind of crazy. And then it comes out in, other ways what happened, and he'll talk about it. But the influence is strong, peer pressure is strong. Us parents are not there when it happens. Come on, stop being a punk. Oh, you're a little sissy boy, or whatever it is that they say to your child. We're not there to stop it. And it's important for parents to teach their kids about no bullying, don't how to be careful with drugs that are floating out there, that are floating around, and it's not cool. It's not cool anymore. You can't experiment. You can't, because it could cost a life. It could cost your child their life. The gummy situation was an eye-opener for so many parents when they saw the 10-year-olds, four of them, all took gummies. And it was devastating. And I remember myself, I took Merrick to the ER, and I have a picture of him probably about 2 months before he passed away. He says, "Mom, my stomach is just bothering me. I think there's something wrong with me, my stomach." And he was complaining about feeling a certain way, and I think it was withdrawals. And he said, "Mom, I need to go to the hospital." So I took him in, and they said, "Oh, we need to get a gastroenterologist." Because at that time, Tyler's Law had not quite passed, and he was in the hospital. I didn't know that they weren't testing for fentanyl. Had they tested him for fentanyl, they probably would have known that it was in his system. I'm suspecting it was fentanyl, because when people talk about the first time they do it in the withdrawal, the little feeling they get. My son thought, he never asked to go to the hospital. He could hurt himself real bad. I'm like, "You need to go to the hospital." No, I got this, So for him to ask to go to the hospital, I was like, this is a big deal. And I took him, and he says, "Mom, can you take a picture of me in the hospital so I can show you?" Because it was a big deal. It would make him more popular. I don't know. So I said, "Sure." And he goes, "Let's do a selfie." So you'll see selfies in him. And he just, we didn't put it together because there was no test for it. And had there been a test for it at that time, he definitely would have been closer and not at a friend's house unless he's telling me where he's going. I try not to be too overbearing. I try not to overdo it and give him space as he needed it to breathe. He has anxiety. And I tell all the parents that kind of blame themselves that you had no idea. I had no idea this was going to happen, let alone the person. I had no idea. And we do what we do as parents at that moment to say, "Hey, you know what? I did my best as a parent. I tried to get him into a rehab. I tried to get him into a program. I tried everything, even if they had an addiction." My son, I thought, okay, just in case, because he kept saying he tried heroin. And so the psychiatrist said, get him into like a dual diagnosis center where they can treat his anxiety, depression, and his autism, as well as possible substance use disorder. And then the two, it resolves anxiety, because then they have therapy for it and they don't feel the need to have to self-medicate. So dual diagnosis, we only have one dual diagnosis center in Sacramento. They're developing more. And fentanyl is a poison. It's not even a drug to treat. It's not like a drug like heroin. You can treat that. Cocaine, you can get off of cocaine. It's hard for people to get off of meth, those types of drugs. But I can tell you that having these centers, they have to know how to deal with fentanyl, specifically fentanyl. And it's the new kid with nitazene, xylazine, carfentanil. This is all new stuff, and they have to know how to treat it. What are the withdrawals like? What are the expectations? When you go through alcohol withdrawal, they know the expectations. It's methodical. It's pretty straightforward for doctors. I truly believe in a doctor monitored detox program where they're put under and detoxed, and then when they go through withdrawals, they treat all the symptoms and all the goings on based on the probes that are on them, their heart rate, their oxygen level, and treat them accordingly. And when they wake up, they're not going to go through a withdrawal process. That part's already done. I fully, truly believe in that. But right after that happens, they have to immediately go into a therapy on how to change their circle, how not to get back into that situation. They have to be real serious to get this. They have to want to stop,
Yes.
because if someone says, "Yeah, I kind of like it. I'll try it." No, they have to want to stop to get this therapy, to get this out of their system. And they need to have that for the more serious people that fell victim to it through a pill, or fell victim to it through something that was snuck in their drug, and they're seeking it because they have to have it. They're
Right.
not seeking it because it was their choice. Somebody made it their choice in the beginning.
Right.
And
Wow.
I think they should have a program like that for
I
people
don't
who
know.
truly.
I agree with you, but I don't think America has those centers. I really don't believe it. And if they do, they don't have enough of them. And
Right.
it's not a priority, just like it's not a priority to arrest the dealers and keep them behind bars before
Right.
their trial comes
Right.
in.
Right. I just it's multifaceted. We know that. There's no one approach. If you are, talking about arresting people and making them held accountable, that definitely needs to be done
Oh, yeah.
to people think about, do I really want to sell that? Do I really want to give that to my friend? Do I really want to? More education needs to be put, and we're doing education. There's so many people that are going to schools and assemblies and spreading the
Yes.
words, multiple counties. And some counties will say, we don't want that at our school because we don't want anyone to
Yes,
think
I
we have a
know.
drug.
Yeah, because then they might want to use it. And it's like
They end up
catch
having the worst.
22.
And they end up having the worst backlash of that decision when they lose multiple kids in a short period of time because it's been ignored,
Yeah.
So it's a multifaceted approach. Some parents look at if your son or daughter's overdosing, or you see that they're nodding out, you see that they're not responsive, this is the action that you need to take. That education has to happen as well.
Yes.
And the simple fact that they cannot give themselves Narcan to reverse, even if they're
Even
falling,
if they
they're.
have it, they can't do it to themselves.
You can't. A person cannot do it to themselves. And I think a lot of people are doing a wonderful job getting that message across. We need to talk to more people like grandparents. You know how grandparents They don't want to devastate the relationship with their grandchild, so they just go with the flow and they become their friend and not their grandparents. And they can't even imagine saying no, or hey, he's just in his room, he needs a space, you know, I'm the grandparent. And they end up dying of fentanyl poisoning at their grandparents' or their auntie's house, or you know, somewhere where they're giving him space. Oh yeah, he could always hang out with me, I'm his auntie, you know. And they're devastated, like, how I'm supposed to be the best auntie in the world and this happened. And again, you know, there's, I tell people, please don't blame yourself. You can only know what you know at the time, you
That's
know,
right.
and all you can do is educate yourself and make sure that nobody else goes through the same thing that you went through as the great auntie that you are. And your nephew would be proud of you, your son would be proud of you to fight this so bravely. It's not easy. It isn't easy.
No.
It's difficult. And sometimes it does bring back things that happened with me. Oh, I had to give my son CPR, and it brings back the time where I was in panic mode, full-blown hyperventilating, wondering if I'm doing the CPR right, wondering if I, you know, could have done more. What if I said no, you couldn't go to your friends? What if I, you know, and I could do all this what if, what if, what if.
Right, what ifs?
And I refused to do that when I realized I took him to all his therapies. I addressed the problems as I knew them. I gave him a skateboard because I really thought child trafficking was my biggest danger out there. I would have never thought in a million years that it would be somebody that we knew that was behind this. And, you know, all I can say is that I don't beat myself up because I file for conservatorship. It's hard to do as an adult because he was over 18 when they granted it. But the judge took the time to talk to him and have a conversation with him. And he realized that, yes, he could be manipulated. And I can't see him taking care of himself like an 18, 19-year-old normally, you know, would be talking about jobs and career and just, you know, Johnny on the spot. And he's talking about his favorite cartoons and Rick and Morty. I don't know if a lot of people know who Rick and Morty and the, you know, Arnold, Hey Arnold, those types of cartoons and anime. And the judge knew, and he said, yes, let's just revisit it every couple of years and see how he's doing. So progress was keyed to me because I figure, you know, I'm coming up on 60 years old. I'm 60 now, and I can say that, you know, I knew I wasn't going to live forever, and I couldn't be his conservatorship. You know, conservatorship wasn't going to last forever, so it was more important for me to educate my son and get him the proper help that he needed the best I could, and know that he had could live in a facility where they cook for him, they make sure he has medication, but he has his peace and quiet, he can come and go as he pleases. I found a program like that. And but they have a curfew, of course, they have rules. And I was talking about how important it is to follow rules, and I wanted to make sure that he was okay in case something happens to me or his dad. And I was figuring all that out. And then this happened. And I thought, this is just, I would say that the floor fell out from underneath me. But because I've gone through so much, it felt like the earth just cracked in half and I fell right through. I was like, I was in a spiral that I didn't want to be in. I was in such a bad place that I couldn't even understand what just happened. Carfentanil, what is that? I had to look it up in Google and research, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it was mind-blowing that here we have people dying of fentanyl. How many people don't know about this carfentanil? It's 100 times more potent. So you see those little 2 grains of sand? It can
Right.
kill one person. Those same grains of sand can kill 100. 100. And he had 87 in his system.
Oh my God.
And that could kill hundreds of people. Hundreds on hundreds. And I learned that, and the first thing that came to my mind was, this is no accident. Something happened. And I kept digging. And I give it to the moms that are just like me, and most of us have done our own investigation, and it's not easy. Time, you have to take a break, you have to take a mental break. Some things that I recovered, it just made me cry. It just made me think that he was failed. One time he was, I told you about the one dual diagnosis center that we have is Heritage Oaks. He got kicked out of Heritage Oaks because of his autism, because he blurts and he says inappropriate things, and that's what he's there for. And I said, he said, but he hurts people's feelings and we can't have him in groups like that. And I said, well, don't have him in a group, just have a one-on-one. He's okay with, well, we just can't do that. We have a regimen. Yeah, they need to change the way they do this for people that are on the spectrum, that blurt, that may say things, or they laugh inappropriately. They don't know that it's not a laughable situation. Like if somebody says, for instance, I was running and I was so scared and I fell, and in his mind, he replays a person running and falling, he'll laugh. Well, the rest of the story, you have to, like, was she okay? A lot of people will understand, but he has this animated, I want to say he was always animated in his life, but he plays it in his head. He goes, Mom, I just couldn't get it out of my head. And I just kept laughing and I couldn't control it. And I explained it. They kicked him out. They said, we can't have that. It was devastating to the person that was telling their story. And I said, explain to the people that he does not have, always have appropriate behaviors, and he may say things that hurts your feelings. He might laugh, but it's okay. He's just different. He doesn't
Right.
mean anything by it. He means nothing by it. And instead of doing that, they kicked him out, and he died within 6 months of being kicked out of the program. And he came out of COVID. He was going to, this bright kid, he went to American River College because he knew he could pass sign language. He already knew it. He goes, I'm going to take American Sign Language and I'm going to be an interpreter. But I said, okay, we can do that. And I want you to take your classes. And then we'll work on how to socialize, and not be anxious for being around people because you'll be helping them. So I was getting him to a point, and he was going to American River College. Then COVID hit. COVID devastated a lot of people and put people on the spectrum and already had anxiety in a downward spiral that I can't even explain to you what my son experienced in front of my eyes at home. It was the worst thing. And he just said, forget it, I'm going outside. I don't care what they said, stay. And I couldn't stop him. And all I could do is the police, all the local police knew that he was on the spectrum, that I was his conservator, and they would bring him back home. But he didn't, the masking and just gave him anxiety. He just couldn't, he would wear it if I got him one that said Raiders, it had to look super cool. Then he would, but he would take off and be around people, and the homeless weren't, and people that he thought that was his friend, they didn't wear masks. And I thought, you're going to get me and your dad sick. You really need to try to stay home. We never got sick, by the way. But he would just do that. He's like, Mom, really? I need to go out. He just was like a volcano. Like, as soon as he feels like he's going to erupt, I'm like, there he goes. He's outside, you know? And there's nothing I could have done differently that
would have made a difference.
Would have made a difference, other than maybe if I said no that day. But I don't beat myself up about it because
I'm glad he has the right. I'm really glad you don't, because you could never have known the day. You could never have known the moment. You could never have known what was going on in the background with them stealing all his things, you know? And I just want to tell you how impressed I am with you, with just everything that you've had to endure. And I mean, you're such an amazing person. I give you so much credit. And then to help all these other people who come after you is a testament to your character.
Yes, I try my best to, and I understand the parent who lost their child in some cases too, you know. It's not easy. It's the most difficult times too, feeling like the earth is swallowing you up. Like there's days that you, I don't know, you know. So I choose to just pull back. And even if I have to go lay back down and start my day over in the middle of the day,
yeah,
that's what I do. I can't reiterate more the importance of your mental health and not to push yourself. And sometimes I have appointments and I'm like, I just can't make it today. And it's okay to reschedule. You know, I tell myself it's okay to reschedule. It's okay not to be perfect. It's okay. I do know that being on the spectrum is very hereditary. It's been known because I've dealt with it with 4 out of my 5 boys that my husband used to label everything and put everything, like even nuts and bolts and screws, and just in little compartments, and they had to be labeled. And yet I love him to death because he's so organized opposite of me. And he will set things up like, you know, my camera, you got to have a microphone. You've got to be able to be like this. And he's like so organized. I'm like, what would I do without this incredible person? But for me, I'm more of English was my first love. And when it came to school, and I realized that I was on the spectrum when I was going, I took debate and I was going up against college students. And I was like, what am I doing? You know, but I've always been strong in being helpful, informative, learning and absorbing and retaining that. Grief brain sometimes makes me forget, and it's frustrating for me because I am on the spectrum that way, where I absorb things, learn it. You don't have to tell me twice. Numbers stick in my head. My son's driver's license number, my driver's license number, my social, everyone's social that was born in my family. It sometimes it gets in the way. It really does. And I tell people in the groups all the time, I'm a little bit, sometimes I can be a bit much, and I don't mean to come across any certain way. It's just, sometimes it takes over and I have to pull back. It's a learned behavior. Everything's a learned behavior. There's no medication for autism. Even my nephew, who couldn't speak at all, learned to be echolalic. It's a learned experience. by enough training, enough learning, repetitive behavior therapy, you learn how to compromise. My oldest son had to learn how to take turns talking. He would not let anyone talk before. He was little. And he learned it. He learned it. And it could be learned through peer pressure too. Like, why do you talk so much? Give me a chance. Yeah, yeah, you can't, you know. So peer pressure will say, oh, I need to watch that, you know.
Yeah.
So this therapy comes in different ways, like, you know, and I'm quick to apologize, like, you know, I didn't mean to, you know, the task seemed so easy to me that, you know, I didn't mean to like feel like I was taking over, you know. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I just wanted to let Matt know, when he said in the groups, we have what we call a newsletter. He said, who wants to tackle MailChimp? That's how we get our newsletter out. And I said, I will. And I only knew this much about MailChimp, but I thought, you know what? I'll do it.
Figure it out.
And I did. And it's amazing. And I feel like I've accomplished something so that I can help get the words and events out to, you know, people in the different groups. It's very satisfying. And it's very important not to put in what I want in there. We have different people that contribute, and I really am grateful for the team and all the input from Terry. And all the input from Matt. Nothing goes out until they look at it. And, you know, what do you think about it? And we're like, it's a go, you know. And that's, for me, I'm doing my son a huge favor by sharing all the information that we have to educate parents in different ways, shapes, and forms that fentanyl can affect their children, to advocating naloxone does work, but be aware that it doesn't work every single time. I don't want people to think it's a false safety net to go ahead and use as long as somebody has a box or two of naloxone. I've seen firefighters give 7 and 8 boxes. It depends on how much fentanyl is in their system. Sometimes it takes more than two, and more education needs to go out about officers that carry it in their vehicles. Do they have, they need a case, you know, just because you never know what you're going to run into. But it does work. It does reverse like it's supposed to, but sometimes people will go back into, being unconscious, and they have to be Narcan again or given naloxone again. And people need to be aware exactly the timing, what you see and what you may experience and how you may need more.
Right.
And that's critical. I'm there to support parents that also have addiction issues.
That's a big thing too.
That's a big thing too, and not to judge, because, you know, like I said, everyone's life is different. Everyone handles stress differently. And it's not our job to judge. We can only be there. And sometimes when they lose a child, it drives them more into their addiction. But it's understanding ears. We have two of them in one mouth, and we need to listen more with these things right here than to talk, and just to understand them and to say, you know what, it's okay. You know what, you're going to be in a better, you know, get yourself in a better position. This is what I suggest. I can't make you do it, but this is a suggestion because I care. I care about you, and I care about what happens to you. You're not by yourself. You can call me anytime. So
and I appreciate that you're there for other people because it's a responsibility that you take on for yourself when you've been through such trauma yourself. And so I just want to thank you for all that you do and for being there for all different people, the
I try.
moms, the siblings, everything, and especially for spending so much time with us today. And I thank you again for being here. And I wish you the very best, you and your family.
Thank you for having me, Mary. This is so important that we had this conversation, and I just really, truly appreciate the opportunity.
You're quite welcome. And my condolences on both your son's death.
Thank you so much.
And I'm plugging for you as you move forward and keep getting that investigation finalized and that it comes together well.
And helping others to learn the process that I had to learn so that
Yes.
they don't have to go through that long
Yeah.
that I had to go through. So drug-induced homicide helped me do it, and druginducedhomicide.org is so critical to go out there. Make a donation. We do everything absolutely free. We don't charge anybody for any information. Narcan is free. The information is free. It's just to support our efforts in making shirts like this for drug-induced homicide so that we can spread the word through people asking, hey, what's your shirt about?
Yes.
And on the back of it says, why do drug dealers get away with murder? It sparks a conversation.
Absolutely.
And it's I'm forever grateful to Drug Induced Homicide because they got me on the right track, the right thinking, and here I
And
am
they're
today.
benefiting from all your great knowledge and wisdom and helping others. So thank you again.
Yes. Thank you.
And to my listeners, please remember to subscribe, rate, review, and like wherever you see us, whether you listen to the audio or you watch the video. It's very important to bring us higher in the algorithms, and it really helps us. So thank you for being here, and we look forward to the next episode. God bless.